Thanks, Pascal, and I want to thank the organizers for giving me the opportunity to speak here. So this is one talk where I think to be a safe bet to assume that almost everyone in the audience will not know at least one word, the meaning of at least one word in the title. So I will take some time to explain at least what is polynomial time hierarchy, what is Tudor's theorem, and what I consider a real analog of Tudor's theorem. And this is joint work with Thierry Zell. Okay, so the outline of the talk is I'll first outline the classical polynomial time hierarchy, which is some kind of a computational complexity theoretic version of the arithmetic hierarchy in logic. And then Bloom-Schuch's Smale models, I do not need to speak a lot about that for this audience. And then some idea of where I'm coming from, namely algorithmic semi-algebraic geometry. And I'll discuss Tudor's theorem on the way. It might be, if I have some time, I'll talk about the proof details and some open questions or research directions. Okay. So let's quick primer of the basic definitions. So initially, let us consider the field K with two elements. I'm going to change this very soon, but just to talk about the discrete case. And with a language, what's usually called a language in this language, is a set of strings, but I consider some subsets of Kn, and a language is a union of such Ln's. And I'll abuse this notation a little bit, and we'll identify this union with this sequence. So Ln is the part of the language of strings of length n. And then it's customary to say that a language is in P if there exists some machine or program that, given a point in Kn, decides whether x is in Ln or not in time, which is bounded by some number of steps, which is bounded by some polynomial in n. This is the only part in these definitions where this machine or a program would play a role, and if you think that this is ill-defined, you can think of any reasonable class of languages, and we'll call it P, but it's a polynomial class. And then such a sequence is in NP if there exists an auxiliary language L prime in P such that X is in Ln. If there exists a Y, so and might be a polynomial M, which is a polynomial in N, such that if there exists a Y in Km, such that Yx is in this auxiliary language, right? So, and it often one says that Y is a certificate or witness for X to be in P. And now, once you see such a definition, you might wonder, as a repetition would, so what happens if I replace this existential quantifier here by a universal quantifier, and then we say the language is in co-NP, if, again, there exists an auxiliary language which is in P such that X is in Ln if and only for all Y in Kn, Yx is in L prime. And again, M here is some fixed polynomial in N. Of course, it's called co-NP because it's easy to check from this definition that a language is in co-NP if its complement, namely the sequence you obtain by taking Kn minus Ln here, is in NP. But once you see these two definitions, the next step would be to think that, okay, we have existential quantifier here, we have universal quantifier here. What happens if we have more alternating sequences of quantifiers? And this is where we get polynomial hierarchy. So a language, I would say, is in sigma omega for some fixed number omega. If, and now this is the same definition again, it's the third time we are seeing this, if there exists an auxiliary language L prime in P such that X is in Ln, if and only if And now you have, instead of one quantifier, you have a fixed number of blocks of quantifiers. So Q1, Q2, up to Q omega is are either existential or universal quantifiers alternating. And it's sigma because the outermost quantifier here is existential quantifier. Okay, so such a so important thing here to understand is this M1, M omega are polynomials in N, but the number of such blocks is fixed. Right? It's some fixed number. And so similarly, a language would be in pi omega, same definition except that the outermost quantifier here is the outermost this quantifier is a universal quantifier. And so from this, these definitions, the special cases, of course, if there are no quantifiers, we get P. If sigma 1 is NP and pi 1 is what we call QNP, there's one block of existential or universal. And it's easy to see that we have the following inclusions almost tautologically, namely that sigma I is included in pi I plus 1 and in sigma I plus 1 and so on. So we can take this hierarchy. So you have a hierarchy here. Namely, you start with P, and you have sigma 1, you have pi 1, and you have sigma 2, and you have pi 2. And all these arrows, all these vertical lines are inclusions, which are tautological in nature, and you have a hierarchy of these classes. And so the polynomial time hierarchy, which we denote by PH, is the union of all these classes. Okay? And of course, it's well known that the central problem in theoretical computer science is to prove that this is indeed a proper hierarchy, and in particular, even to prove that there is a strict inclusion between P and NP. Okay, so that's polynomial time hierarchy. So I need to talk about certain other classes. So in order to develop an algebraic version of complexity theory, Valiant introduced certain complexity classes. Now, not of languages, but rather of functions. And so, in this language, a sequence of, now we are not talking of sequence of subsets of KN, but rather sequences of functions. We should think of them as kind of counting functions. And such a sequence is said to be in class sharp P, right? If there exists some auxiliary language in P such that X is such that for all X in Kn, the value of Fn evaluated at X is the cardinality of the fiber of this language at X. So might be the picture here that you should remember is you have Kn. You have Km, you have the m plus nth piece of the language. This is L n plus n. And if I give you an x in Km, then you look at the fiber over x. So this is, I'll denote by L n plus n x. And the cardinality of this fiber is by definition Fn of x. So a language, a sequence of function Fn is in sharp P if it counts the fibers of some language in P. So that's the, oh, it's right. After so many times, I still forget. Okay. Yeah. Okay. No questions so far. That's good. Now, Toda's theorem is now, I guess, almost 20 years old, and it's a seminal result in discrete complexity theory. And usually in the complexity theory, the inclusions of certain complexity classes are usually trivial to prove. It is to prove that the inclusions are strict. That's often almost impossible to prove. But in fact, Toda's theorem is about an inclusion, not about a proper inclusion. So it says that the polynomial time, the polynomial hierarchy that I defined is contained in P raised to sharp P, where this notation here denotes that this is the class of languages which you can recognize in polynomial number of steps using an oracle that computes functions in sharp P. So there are some well-known sharp P complete problems, for instance, computing the permanent of a 0-1 matrix. It's a sharp P complete function. So in fact, you can just think that if I give you a sort of a black box which can compute the permanent of a matrix, having that, and in fact having it just once, you can decide every language in polynomial hierarchy. Now, part of this thing is trivial because, for instance, if you are allowed to count the number of the cardinality of the fibers, of course P is in that, you don't even need any advice to. But even if you allow to count the fiber, then you can in particular decide whether the fiber is empty or the whole space. So the fact that sigma 1 and pi 1 is included in PS sharp P is no surprise, but it gets tricky to prove these higher parts, and it's not that obvious. In fact, I feel it's a sort of mysterious proof to me, even though discrete complexity theorists tell me that, well, this is old news and so on, but it goes in two steps and some auxiliary random classes come in between, and okay. And in computer science parlance, people say that this theorem illustrates the power of counting. So if you are given the power to count, then you can decide everything in polynomial hierarchy. Okay. So that's as much as I'm going to say about the definitions, polynomial hierarchy and sharp P, just to give a motivation of where I'm going. Now, Bloom-Schultz Mayer model, and to me, in fact, this is the only model, and one should just think in terms of this model, and the whole of discrete complexity theory is a special case when you take K to be a finite field. But I'm not going to be interested in the case when K equals complex numbers, real numbers. So in particular, let me remind you that a VHS machine, so now I'm going to replace K instead of the finite field by C or R, and so the languages would now be subsets of Kn, but a VHS machine would accept in the case when K equals C, yes, each Sn would be a constructible subset of Cn, so defined by some finite number of polynomial equations in equations. In the case when K equals R, such an Sn would always be a semi-algebraic subset. Now, but in the way I define this polynomial hierarchy, it's now immediately clear, once you know what it means for a language now over reals and complex numbers to be in P, the corresponding classes like NP, co-NP, or more generally the sigma I and the pi I's are immediately defined because those are defined in terms of these quantifiers. So we have no problem in what is the polynomial hierarchy, so that's clear. Also, BSS developed a theory of NP-completeness. So in case when K equals C, you have the problem of determining if N plus 1 polynomial equations in N variables has a common zero. But in Cn, so maybe this will come up a little later. See, this problem in which is NP-complete has proved to be NP-complete BSS, is testing existence of solutions in affine space, not projective space. This, and also in the case of R, there's a NP corresponding NP complete problem, NPR complete degree for the problem of determining if a quartic polynomial has a real solution. And just like, or probably as a general phenomenon, we shall know whether P equals NP in either of these cases, or for that matter, whether the polynomial hierarchy is proper or not. Okay. So for the moment, for the rest of the talk, I'm going to restrict to the real case, even though I could now also talk in the complex case, but we'll restrict to the real case. And I remind you that such a real machine accepts semi-algebraic subsets of Rn, and a semi-algebraic subset is a subset defined by Boolean formula whose atoms are polynomial equalities and inequalities. Now, let me go back. I said that I would say where I come from in these problems. So my interest mostly is in algorithmic semi-algebraic geometry. And algorithmic semi-algebraic geometry has to do with algorithms for deciding or computing properties of semi-algebraic sets. And if you look in, for instance, in our book on algorithms in real algebraic geometry, there are two important, the algorithmic problems studied fall into two broad subclasses. There is this problem which started the constructed side of this field, namely the problem of quantifier elimination, which in the case of real fields was proved by Tarski and Seidenberg, and the special cases of deciding a sentence in the first order theory of reals, for instance, deciding emptiness of semi-algebraic sets. So these are decision problems. So you are given some sentence of the form, for all x there exists y, so that for all z some polynomial is bigger than zero, or some other polynomial equals zero, something like that, and you want to know whether such a sentence is true or false. And there is a lot of work, of course, in and then there are these problems of computing some topological invariants of semi-algebraic sets, such as the number of connected components of a given semi-algebraic set, the Euler-Poincaré characteristic, more generally all the Betti numbers of the semi-algebraic sets. And for those of you who probably are uncomfortable with all Betti numbers, it would probably suffice to know that these are, for a semi-algebraic set in RK, they are at most k non-zero Betti numbers, and the zeroth Betti number counts the number of connected components, and the highest one that can be non-zero, namely the k minus 1th Betti number, counts in some vague sense the number of independent chambers in this set, if you want to say that. Now, if from the algorithmic complexity side, deciding sentence in the first order theory of reals is something that Jim Renninger gave the first, the most efficient asymptotic algorithm, has a complexity which is, if you fix the number of quantifier alternations, like we did in the polynomial time hierarchy, this is single exponential in the number of variables. Yeah. Similarly, computing the topological invariants, like the number of connected components of the Euler-Poincaré characteristic, can also be done in single exponential time. For the Betti numbers, we now know, or the higher Betti numbers, so the zeroth Betti number is the number of connected components. For the higher Betti numbers, we now know single exponential time algorithms for few of them, but we still do not know a single exponential time algorithm for computing all of them. And this is because of the fact that we do not, well, one reason that we do not know is we do not know how to triangulate semi-algebraic sets using a single exponential number of simplices, for instance. But it is probably, I don't want to conjecture, but it is a reasonable conjecture to make that you can should be able to compute Betti numbers in single exponential time. Okay, but if we look at these two kinds of problems, it immediately reminds us of in discrete complexity theory of the two sides of the inclusion in Toda's theorem. namely the general, the problem of deciding quantified statements with fixed number of quantifier alternations is obviously almost analogous to the language in polynomial hierarchy. And then the business of computing some invariants, discrete invariants of topological setting should be thought of as, and we'll make this precise in a moment, of this class sharp P. So this is obvious, and I would make a thesis that in fact this class sharp P should be thought of in terms of identified with the problem of computing topological invariants, and namely the Betti numbers, which generalizes the notion of cardinality for finite sets. So it is thus quite natural to seek a real analog of Toda's theorem. So what such a real analog should say, and this is not obvious, is that if you are allowed, if I give you a black box to which is able to compute the Betti numbers of semi-algebraic sets, then by referring to this black box, you should be able to decide sentences in polynomial hierarchy. And again, it is clear that P sigma 1 pi 1 if you can compute the Betti numbers of the fibers, you can decide whether a fiber is non-empty, because then B0 of this fiber would be non-zero. And you should also be able to decide that the fiber is everything, because then you know that the... But apart from this, the higher part is not clear at all. That how do you... And that's the obstruction of trying to prove Toda's theorem in the real case, just like it was finite field case. Okay, so let's try to now be a little bit more precise. So in order to define the real analog of counting classes, it's necessary to identify what's the proper notion of counting in the context of semi-algebraic geometry. Now, this has been attempted before, and there are counting complexity classes over the reals that have been defined previously by Klaus Meier and then studied by other authors, Peter Philippe. And more or less, well, Meier's definition was a straightforward generalization of counting, namely, you count a semi-algebraic set, it's the cardinality, it's finite, and you say it's infinite otherwise. But this is not probably a satisfactory notion of counting, since after all, when the semi-algebraic set is infinite, it gives no information. And the most interesting, well, that's of course a matter of debate, but to me, most interesting semi-algebraic sets are positive dimensional. So before I give my definition, our definition of counting, I must say that there's an intermediate notion, which is probably the right notion, which is to consider the count of a semi-algebraic set to be a generalized Euler Poincaré characteristic, which is something which is a discrete analog of volume, because it is the only additive valuation on the space of semi-algebraic sets. However, the Euler Poincaré characteristic, at least in the real case, suffers from a problem, namely that the Euler Poincaré characteristic of a non-empty semi-algebraic set could be zero. So for instance, any odd dimensional sphere would have Euler Poincaré characteristic zero. So the Euler Poincaré characteristic would not distinguish a non-empty odd dimensional sphere from the empty fiber, for instance. So if you cannot distinguish an odd dimensional sphere from the empty fiber, it seems hard to even prove that NP is included in this class PO to sharp P. So the probably slightly less satisfactory, and in any case, we are unable to prove Toda type theorem with just information of the Euler Poincaré characteristic or this naive notion of counting, which was in the previous slide. But to me, it's probably okay to allow ourselves to not just the Euler Poincaré characteristic, but in fact, all the Betti numbers of X. So more succinctly, we define the Poincaré polynomial of f to be the polynomial which records all the Betti numbers. And to me, counting a semi-algebraic set would mean computing its Poincaré polynomial. So that would be the notion of counting. It will not matter, but you can think of in a field with coefficient z mod 2 in the real case. Or, in fact, even with coefficients in z, it's the same. In case the cardinality is finite, then we know that it still recovers the notion of the cardinality by, so you can count the number of connected components of S by setting T to 0. If S is compact, then you can recover the Euler Poincaré characteristic by setting T to minus 1. So it's more general than either of those two notions. And so now let me give my definition of what one should consider is short P, analog of short P over the reals. And I put a dagger there because this notion differs from notions defined by previous authors who considered the more naive notion of counting. So we call a sequence of functions, but now instead of z, I go to z of t to be in the class short p dagger. If there exists an auxiliary family in p, just like in there, and such that given x in Rn, so now k is R, L is my f, fn of x is the Poincaré polynomial of the fiber, is the Poincaré polynomial of the fiber of this auxiliary set over x. Okay, so this is in analogy with the discrete case, and in fact the discrete case is a special case of this. And so, I also want to make a remark here that this relation between counting points of varieties and Betti numbers is more direct over fields of positive characteristic via deep algebraic geometry of Deligne and Weyl conjectures and so on, so via the zeta function. And the zeta function of a variety, and it's mentioned by Hovansky in his talks, is exponential generating function of a sequence whose nth term is the number of points of the variety over the nth extension of the prime field. And it's known that the zeta function depends on the Betti numbers of the variety with respect to some more sophisticated cohomology theory. And thus the problem of counting varieties in kind of naive notion of counting number of points in it, and computing Betti numbers are connected at a somewhat deeper level, and our definition of P sharp of this sharp P over R or over C for that matter is not entirely ad hoc. In some fields of positive characteristic, it's well known that there is a actual connection between counting and Betti numbers. Okay, with all this background, it is now natural to formulate the following conjecture, which is that the polynomial hierarchy over the reals should be included in this class where you are allowed to compute Betti numbers of semi-algebraic sets by making some kind of oracle call in polynomial time. Unfortunately, because of technical reasons which we cannot quite overcome, we are unable to prove this. So I think this is a very interesting problem as it stands, but without a further compactness hypothesis on the left-hand side. So we are going to prove an inclusion, but this inclusion would be something smaller than the polynomial time hierarchy, and this smaller part that will prove included in here is, one should think of it as, well, probably a little misleadingly, as a compact fragment. So of course, in the polynomial time hierarchy consists of semi-algebraic sets, and these semi-algebraic sets need not be closed or bounded or even locally closed, but we are going to only consider those that are compact. All the sets are compact, but it's somewhat more than that in the sense that not only would the sets have to be compact, but the weaknesses or the co-weaknesses exists and for all, these should also vary over compact sets. So the compact fragment. So it's going to follow the same definition of polynomial hierarchy. So this C here is the added part, which is the compact. And so if there, so we'll call, now of course one has to choose, so the sets that we compact and we want them to be in some compact domain. So there's a choice here of what kind of compact domain. So it's natural in real algebraic geometry to compactify the Rn with one point, and then you get this sphere. So that's, so we are only going to consider closed subsets of spheres as, but one could consider unit balls or projective spaces, things like that. But so we will call a sequence of semi-algebraic subsets, now not of Rn, but of the n-dimensional sphere, to be unit sphere, if you want, to be in sigma r omega compact. If there exists another auxiliary language in P such that each Sn prime is compact, and for all x, and now it's everything is as before, so x is in Sn, it can only if, so these are quantifiers, the only difference is that the quantifiers are also varying over compact sets. And the compact class phi c omega is defined analogously. Now, I want to make a remark here. Okay, so if, before I make the remark, so the compact polynomial hierarchy is, again, the union of the compact sigmas and the compact pi's. And notice that all semi-algebraic sets belonging to any language are all semi-algebraic compact, because they're all closed semi-algebraic subsets of the sphere. So to see that, you have to imagine that, so the, of course, the existential quantifier is fine. The projection of a compact goes to a compact. If the if you have the universal quantifier, then what do? You take the complement upstairs, which becomes open subset of the sphere. You project it, but the projection is an open mass, so you get open, and then you take the complement, so it's always closed. And notice this inclusion that the compact part is always included in the non-compact part. Now, so the theorem that we are going to show is that this compact fragment is included in this P, and we cannot show the larger non-compact. Well, I want to make a remark here, which might be important for other purposes, not just for this theorem, that even though the restriction to compact semi-algebraic sets might appear to be a technicality and might be that something we are not able to do, but this is actually an important restriction. So for instance, I think it's a long-standing question whether there exists an NPR complete problem which is in this compact class by my definition, which is NP-complete. So for instance, the problem that is proved in the book of Bloom, Schultz, Mayle, and Cooker, that the quartic polynomial, deciding the zeros of quartic polynomial, but the zeros would come from affine space if you restrict it to, if you consider the problem of whether a homogeneous polynomial of degree 4 has a solution in projective space, so this is no longer known to be NP-complete. So that's probably a little unsatisfactory, but that's what it is. So that might be an important restriction. And we'll see where this compactness assumption comes from. Okay, so we have the setup and we have the theorem. And might be, I'll say now a few words about the proof. So our main technical tool is a topological construction that does the following. So suppose you are given a semi-algebraic set in Rn plus n, and you have the projection onto Rn along the Rm. So let's say projection along pi, the y coordinates. Then we are able to construct efficiently some other semi-algebraic set that lives somewhere else. Now this semi-algebraic set has the so if you also fix some p here, so this semi-algebraic set has the property that it has the same Betti numbers up to p, or from 0 to p minus 1, as the projection of s along the y coordinates. Now bear in mind that even if there exists an efficient way, an efficient algorithm for checking membership in S, the same need not be true for the image, right? If this were the case, then P would be equal to NP. So we cannot obtain efficient description or even an efficient algorithm to check membership in the projection of S, but we are able to still construct something from what we have upstairs and this projection map, some other set to which we can check membership efficiently, and which has the property that it recovers somewhat the topology of the image. So we have construction upstairs that recovers the topology of the image. And so this takes care, so this is the part that takes care of the existential quantifier, which is more or less corresponds to projection along certain coordinates. And then for the universal quantifier, when there's quantifier alternation, one has to look at complements. And so the second topological ingredient is well-known Alexander Lefschetz duality, which relates the Betti numbers of a compact subset of the spheres to that of the complement. So these are the mean, so there's a topological construction for doing the projection, and there is a second topological ingredient for taking care of complements. And might be I go through some of the trivial cases first, just to give you an indication of what goes on here. So first consider this kind of the level. So you just have some semi-algebraic set in a product space, and you have the projection along the L coordinates. And suppose you have a formula like that with one existential quantifier, and it is satisfied by some, so such a formula is satisfied by some point x in Sk. So if and only if the b0 of the fiber is not zero, right? And so thus, if you can compute the Betti numbers of Fx, the fiber, then you are done, because this is the remark that this inclusion is trivial, that the problem of deciding the truth of Px is reduced to computing a certain Betti number of the fiber S over X. The other inclusion, this one, is also trivial, because this is the for all Y. So using the same notation, so suppose you have now a C of X, the formula is for all Y, P of XY. So such a formula is satisfied by X if the fiber upstairs, it's for all y, so the fiber has to be a sphere, so which means that the complement is empty, but this is equivalent to saying that the LS Betti number of the fiber is 1. So the only semi-algebraic set of the L-dimensional sphere which has LS Betti number 1 is the sphere. And then if you are able to compute the fiber, the Betti numbers are the fiber, but just looking at one of the Betti numbers, you are able to decide whether C of X is satisfied or not. Notice though, even though this is still trivial, we needed not just the 0th, but the Lth Betti number. So in the first case, the 0th suffice. This case, we have to look at a higher Betti number. And this is the reason why we cannot compute with just the number. We cannot prove this theorem by just knowing that the number of connected components, say, of the fiber, because we really need to know all the Betti numbers. And when there are more quantifier alternations, things really get mixed up, and so we really need information on the sequences. And now, slightly more non-trivial case, and this is the case pi 2, this one. So suppose you have a set S in a product like that. Now you have two projections. So we first project along the Z coordinates to SK times SL. And then on that, you have a projection along the Y coordinates from SK to SL, times SL to SK. And now let's consider a pi 2 type formula, namely phi of x is for all y that exists z such that phi of x, y, z. And now I want to know that for all x in xk, phi of x is true. Well, when is phi of x true? When for all, so this is true, if for all y that is true, and that is true means that the projection along the image of the projection along the z coordinate must be SL. Of course, if you are looking at the fiber over x. And now this is where we need our topological construction, because we do not have a description of this set. But what we do have is some other semi-algebraic set that we have constructed, whose first, whatever number we want, we put here, Betti numbers are equal to the Betti numbers of the projection. So if we have such a set, and if we know that we can test efficiently in polynomial time membership to that set, then we can call our oracle and ask it to test, to compute the Betti numbers of this set, which by our assumption we have access to. And once we get the answer, then this is equivalent to knowing that BL is equal to 1. Okay, so this is for one level of quantifier alternation. And now, of course, if you have multiple levels, the inductive so this is what I said, that for in this case, the important thing here to note is that we are given S is efficiently testable, and given that you can test membership in S efficiently, then you are able to test membership with this set efficiently. And the construction assures you of this. And then, if you know you are given the Betti numbers of this set, then you can decide whether X is in the language. And so, the idea behind the general proof of, as we go up in the hierarchy here, is that there's a recursive application of the same argument. So we just discussed this argument up to pi 2, but you can imagine that if you have a little more, then it takes a bit more to write down. But this is so when the number of quantifier alternations is larger, but remember it's still bounded by some constant for any language in the polynomial hierarchy, so we have to keep track of the growth of the sizes of the intermediate formulas, so the number of quantified variables, and you have to make sure that everything stays polynomially bounded. But that's the idea of the proof, modulo the construction of this strange set that recovers back the topology of the image from something upstairs. Okay, is that... And so it might be in the remaining time, so how much? Do I have?
Oh,
you
can get 5 minutes.
Or 5 minutes? Okay.
10 minutes
we start. Okay. Yeah. So I'll just so the mean. So I will skip the key proposition because it's kind of technical, but it just summarizes what I said before about the construction of this set, but in the case of several levels of quantifier alternation. So let me just skip this. So let me just say a few words about how does one construct such a set. So remember, you have a set upstairs, you have the image under projection, you want to describe another set which would be efficiently, to which you can test membership efficiently, if you can test membership efficiently to S, such that the Betti numbers of this bigger set, or first P Betti numbers of the bigger set, would be the same as the Betti numbers of downstairs. And the important topological construction is that of the join of two topological spaces. And the join of two topological spaces intuitively is just you take the two spaces and you obtain the space by joining every point in X by every point in Y by a segment. So that's the topological join. Of course, algebraic geometers have a different notion of what is meant by join, and that's, that will give you a different topological object. But this is the topological join. And so, for instance, it's easy to check if you take the join of two spheres, then you get another sphere. But here you observe that a sphere is highly connected, right? So its very numbers are 0 up to n, other than b0, and then you get something that's even highly connected. And this is a general phenomenon. So if you take the join of this space iteratively, so you take the join of xp times, so again, there is a general definition, but it's just an associative operation, so you can think of taking the join one at a time, then the, let me just say, it's a basic fact in topology that if you do so, then you get an object that's very highly connected. So if you take the infinite join, for instance, of a space, you get something that's homotopic to the Wankel point. But if you take some finite number of joins, then you get something that's p equivalent to a point, and what's p equivalent to a point, roughly speaking, means that the first p homology groups, other than the zeroth one, is zero. So that's an important thing. And the one thing that we need to consider is not the join, but, so we have now not only a set, but also a projection, some map. So we have to consider the p plus one fold join of A over this map. So if we do so, if we take a join of these objects several times over a map, then an individual fiber is an ordinary join of the individual fibers, right? So, and we know that an ordinary join taken p times is highly contractible, highly connected, because it's p equivalent to a point. Now you have, in topology, a famous theorem, Vieter is Bessel theorem, which tells you that if you have a map such that the fibers are all trivial, contractible, let's say, then this is a homotopy equivalent, as long as the map is a nice map. We have a situation where the fibers are not homotopy equivalent, but it's highly connected, right? It's trivial till dimension p, and then there is a version of Vieter's theorem that tells you in this case, such a map will induce isomorphism and homology up to n. So if we can construct, if we have a projection which has some nice properties, which we do have, and this is why we need the compactness assumption, and we have a fiber join, then the fiber join has this property that it recovers the first p homology Betti numbers of the image. So that's topological construction, and of course the fiber join, if the join itself was defined in terms of some equivalence relation, so this is not something semi-algebraic. So what we need to do, and this is what we achieve, is that we can construct a semi-algebraic set dy of s, which is homotopy equivalent to the corresponding fiber join, and in a way that taking membership in this, so it's up to homotopy, this is the fiber join, can be checked in polynomial time. So that's more or less the topological ingredient of the proof. That brings me to the end of my talk, so I just want to discuss a couple of my future work and open problems. So I think the primary open problem is to remove the compactness hypothesis, which I do not know how to do. The complex version, well, now I have a preprint with a similar compactness hypothesis, so nothing without. Now this might be very ambitious, but why not? So try to obtain the classical Toda's theorem using algebraic geometric means. And this is, once you have the complex version, this probably suggests what to do, but this would involve thinking in terms of things like etal, homotopy, I don't know what. And finally, in this whole business, we have been talking about the sequences of functions. These functions are functions of special kind. These functions are what's usually called constructible functions. And if you go back to the original definition of Schott P, it came into being because of this valence theory of constructing a kind of analogous parallel complexity theory of counting functions, and maybe there is a similar theory that should be developed, which should be generalized in the real and the complex case, or more arbitrary structures in the sense of VSS, since VSS is, after all, the model of complexity theory over all fields. So we have a, might be a, some formulation of this kind involving, of course, this kind of topological counting, but so this is some open area for people to pursue if there's some any interest. Sorry for taking a few extra minutes. Thank you.